Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Our guest today is John Fia, professor of history at Messiah College and previous guest on our podcast. Although he is listed as the chair of the Department of History at Messiah, he is currently on research sabbatical, meaning that anarchy is probably reigning amongst his historian colleagues there. Professor Fia is a specialist in early American and church history, having earned a Master's of Divinity and Master's of Arts in Church History at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and a PhD in American History at SUNY Stony Brook. He is the author of many scholarly articles and four solo-authored books, including Why Study History? Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? The Way of Improvement Leads Home, Philip Vickers Fithian and the Rural Enlightenment in Early America, and most recently, The Bible Cause, A History of the American Bible Society. He also blogs regularly at The Way of Improvement Leads Home, conveniently titled after his first book. All of these books and his blog can be found at our website, and we will post links to them also at our Facebook and Twitter pages. Check this stuff out, I say. John, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me back, Tony, and I also might add, even though I am not at Messiah, anarchy is not reigning. My colleagues Jim LeGrand and Norm Wilson are running the department while I'm gone, and everything's going fine. So I wouldn't want to get into trouble here with my administration by suggesting that there's anarchy in the history department.
Okay,
so, somebody correction to start off.
Somebody is in charge. Okay, that's good to know because
that's right.
Yeah, when I contacted you, you said I'm on sabbatical, but it says you're the history chair, and I go, oh my gosh, who knows what historians will do when they're unsupervised?
Well, the other thing is too. I'm hoping everything's going well because I only have one more year of doing this, so I hope the history department will be in good hands and maybe some people are getting some training for how to run a department after I step down.
What, 1 year of being chair, not 1 year of being a historian?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, year of being chair.
Well, we still want you to be a historian because you write a bunch of
stuff.
That's
right. Well, that's what I'm hoping by not being chair, I'll have more time to be a historian.
Oh, well, you have lots of time to do that, I think, because you got four books already, two of them which have question marks in their titles, and then two of them that have periods, which means you're finding the answers finally, I guess. But I actually have to ask you about one, because we did a podcast earlier on Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? And since that time, you wrote Why Study History? And that's an interesting book. We don't want to focus on that today. We want to go to the American Bible Society, but I'm curious about that book. So I ask you, why study history? Why indeed?
Yeah, I wrote this book actually as a sort of primer for history majors, first semester freshman history majors who take a course I teach in Intro to History. But I also hope, and actually this has been what's happening, that the book is going to get some traction among people who just want to, you know, are history buffs or want to know what the importance of history is to society. There's a lot of reasons, you know, why one should study history. But I think, especially in this political season that we're in right now, history, like a lot of the humanities disciplines, teaches us how to make compelling arguments, listen to people who are different than us. You know, the past is a foreign country, we like to say. Visiting the past is like entering a foreign country where you're forced to try to understand people on their own terms and empathize with them. Not necessarily sympathize, but empathize. Try to understand where they stand, walk in their shoes. It teaches us that we are small in light of the vast expanse of human history. In that sense, it sort of decenters us, relieves us of our narcissism, forces us to see ourselves as less important than we really are. And in some ways, I think these are good virtues for any democratic society. So that's one reason. I think that's the most important reason in terms of our political climate right now. It teaches us to kind of listen to each other, realize that things are a lot more complex and nuanced when we think about studying the human experience as it changes over time.
Yeah, I think that is a good lesson. Understanding people on your own, on their own terms, in their own context, I think is a very important lesson. That
yeah, I mean, you don't. It's necessarily, Tony. You know, you don't have to agree with them, but right. I mean, I think our democracy goes a lot farther if you at least, you know, how do you critique someone if you don't understand their position? So
yeah, and we oftentimes have a tendency to evaluate people based upon our own context and see things that
That's
way.
Right.
So it's good that we talk to historians, and historical topics are usually one of our most popular episodes, so I'm glad to have you on here. And today we want to talk about your new book on the American Bible Society. It's 200 years old this year. So what drove you to look at this 200-year-old institution?
Yeah, 200-year, interesting, 200 years old on May 11th, so it's coming up. So for some reason, the book was released right about the time of, you know, you know, weeks before the 200th anniversary.
History is coincidental.
One of the reasons why I took this project, you know, it was very simple. They contacted me at first.
Mm.
You know, they know I've written about religion and American history and the American nation, Christian, the relationship between Christianity and American nationalism. And initially, they wanted me to write a kind of coffee table, kind of commemorative, hagiographical, you know, go ABS, go American Bible Society, and in some ways even a providential history, right? Here's what God has done over the last 200 years. And, you know, as a Christian, I'm not opposed to that kind of stuff, but that's not the kind of history writing that I do. So we initially parted ways and said, you know, I don't think this is going to work out. And they came back to me several months later and said, you know, we really want you to write this book. You know, what do you want to do? I thought the American Bible Society, I still do, obviously, would make a wonderful window into understanding the role of the Bible in American life, American religious history, and American history generally. Because as I argue in the book, the American Bible Society is there at, you know, every major event in American history over the last 200 years. They're engaged in some kind of way, largely in terms of distributing Bibles. So we negotiated. It's a little bit of an unusual book for an academic. It's certainly published by an academic press, Oxford, but at the same time, I am writing an institutional history with the help of that institution. Now, initially, they wanted to pay me to write the book. I thought that, you know, if I'm going to have academic freedom to write the book the way I want to write it, I said, you can't pay me because then I, you know, how can I, you know, I won't have any integrity as a historian. We did arrange, I'm pretty open and upfront about this. We did arrange that they would help pay for some of my expenses, the train rides back and forth between Harrisburg and their archives, which were then in New York City at their Bible House, as they called it. So they did give me a little bit of support, and they gave me unlimited access to their archives, which no historian has had, or very few, I should say, historians have had over the years. So in that sense, you know, I am writing a book for an institution on their 200th anniversary, but they did give me complete academic freedom to write the book in the way I want. You know, I wanted to write it as a scholar. At the same time, you know, again, I'm fine talking about this. I'm open and upfront about this. At the same time, I mean, as a Christian, you know, I'm to an extent kind of supportive of the mission of the American Bible Society. So I think I was a safe bet, you know, by giving me academic freedom. I don't think they thought I was going to sort of bludgeon the institution or you know, really undermine the institution. But I did try to tell a story that I think is fair. And is really reflects some of the ups, the downs, the bright sides, the dark sides, and so forth of this very, very important and I think overlooked institution in American history.
So, just to clarify, you're not captured by Big Bible.
No, the big Bible. That's good. That's right. Yeah, I'm. Uh, I'm taking on. I'm not sort of captive to. I don't give $250,000 speeches, I should say, for the American Bible Society. No, they don't pay me to.
Okay. Yeah. It's I'll vouch for the book. It is a very good read. I think it's a read that very accessible to the public. It is interesting. I know a lot of people might say, "Oh, it's a very narrow institution," but it does cover swaths of American history. Right. We're going to run across the Civil War, World War One, Reconstruction Movement, all the way up to present time, and it's a very well balanced book, and it's just it's people being people.
Histories are just, I've never written one before. I don't know if I ever want to write one again. I mean, they're hard to make interesting. I'll admit that, and I know that's not conducive to sort of me being out there sort of promoting the book for Oxford, but hopefully I made an institution somewhat compelling by connecting it to a larger narrative of American history. Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, let's go ahead and dig into that larger American narrative, but I want to actually start by starting the clock in present time, and then we'll rewind the tape. Sure. And you do this in your book as well, as you note in the introduction, you tell a story about two people, somebody in Nebraska and somebody in New York City, two worlds apart, but in the same institution, looking at the world differently, and at a time when the American Bible Society is making a move. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. John Erickson, who I actually flew out to this little corner of Nebraska, Crawford, Nebraska, to interview, and Roy Peterson, who is the current CEO of the American Bible Society, they're about a generation apart in terms of age. John is retired. He's retired to Nebraska. John represents everything about the American Bible Society as it functioned in the 20th century. In many ways, the American Bible Society, and I say this at the beginning of the book, and maybe we'll return to this, but the American Bible Society has always worked with the manifestation of American Christianity, particularly American Protestantism, that holds sort of political, cultural power in the United States. And after, say, the 1920s, when you have this fundamentalist modernist controversy in which the liberal Protestants, the main line, if you will, sort of, won the day in these denominations and gained control, the American Bible Society tended to work with them, mainline Protestants for the most part. So that means they're very much interested in the ecumenical movement within Protestantism, things like the National Council of Churches, the World Council of Churches, these kinds of things. Now, it's not that sort of evangelical Protestants are not there, but they play a very small role. In some ways, their role is token in the board and in the staff of the American Bible Society. So for much of the 20th century, it's very much a mainline institution. John Erickson is a good ELCA Lutheran. Actually, he's been around in Lutheran circles before they were the ELCA. He's a Augustana Swedish Lutheran, and he represents the Bible, the mainline idea of the Bible Society as a service agency. That's a business that sells Bibles to help churches. Now, that doesn't make it any less a kind of Christian organization. They're very interested in spreading, distributing Bibles to people who need them, and then, let those churches, let those denominations, let those missions agencies do with the Bible what they want, interpret it the way they want, and so forth. But the American Bible Society, to him, is very much understood. They measure success by what we might call tonnage, or what the critics of people like John Erickson call tonnage, meaning how many Bibles, every year do we send out, so it's all numbers, right? If we send out 5 million Bibles this year, it's been a successful year. Roy Peterson represents a shift that took place in the 1990s in the American Bible Society, Roy Peterson again being the current CEO, in which the president at the time in the 1990s, a man named Eugene Habecker, realized that maybe this historic mission of the American Bible Society to circulate and distribute Bibles has come to an end. Because, frankly, he argues, everybody has a Bible. He estimates that 90 to 95% of American households that are Christian have a Bible in their homes. It's pretty easy to get a Bible. In fact, he's actually reacting to a glut in Bible sales that took place in the 1990s, in which Christian bookstores are sending back Bibles because they can't sell, you know, all these different translations and so forth. And so Habecker says, well, maybe we need to stop thinking of ourselves as just a organization that distributes and circulates and translates the Bible, but maybe we should start thinking ourselves more as a ministry to provide resources to teach people how to use the Bible and read the Bible and the buzzword that eventually comes about in the late 20th, 21st century, to engage the Bible. So that's the transition. And the other part of this transition, just to sort of wrap this up, is that Habecker really represents a much more evangelical approach to this. He's much more interested in using the Bible as a tool of evangelism, as a and interpreting the Bible and helping communities to interpret the Bible. You know, so they work with some Catholics, they work with evangelicals, you know, to try to give them resources and Bible study tools. This would be something that the 20th century mainliners like John Erickson would have thought to be beyond the scope of the American Bible Society, because the Constitution of the American Bible Society made it clear that the Bible would be distributed, quote-unquote, without note or comment, and it was up to the denominations and the churches to provide the interpretation. Habecker and now Roy Peterson in the 21st century very much on board with this idea that they've thrown out the phrase without note or comment, and now they really want to teach people how to use the Bible, much like, say, a church would do.
So the institution is changing, and that's actually a theme that you developed through your book, because this isn't just the first change. It's gone through many changes throughout the 200-year history. And you also start your book by emphasizing four themes in the process of the 200 years of the American Bible Society. Go ahead and review those for us, and then we'll step back 200 years and trace history through there and get back to our point where we are today.
Sure. I mean, one I've already mentioned, right, is that the American Bible Society is always working in from a position of religious and cultural power. So in the early 19th century, when the American Bible Society is founded, and we could talk more about this, the American Bible Society is very much an evangelical institution, which makes for some really interesting conversation among the current administration, who likes to appeal, you know, skip over the 20th century when they tell their story and appeal back to those early Second Great Awakening evangelical early 19th century Bible Society founders, who are much more interested in evangelism and teaching people how to use the Bible. So they're always at the center of power. I think a second thing is their identity has always been up in the air. What are they? And it's changed. They start off as a benevolent society, a society that is going to try to bring a form of reform, Christian reform, to the country and to Christianize the nation, much like, say, the American Temperance Union would do, or the American Sunday School Movement, the anti-slavery societies of the 19th century. Later on, they become, as we've talked about, very much a service organization, serving churches. They've been seen themselves as a business. Many people think that the American Bible Society, if they've ever heard of the American Bible Society, is in the business of distributing free Bibles, like the Gideons say today, the Gideons being those that ministry where you go into a hotel and they have the Bible in the drawer. American Bible Society is a business in the sense that they measure success based on not only how many Bibles they distribute, but how many Bibles they sell. So they're very much interested in much of the 19th and early 20th century in selling cheap Bibles, right, and undercutting the other Bible sellers, who really can't compete because the American Bible Society has the ability to mass produce. So this identity in terms of, what are they? Are they a business? Are they a mission, a benevolent society, a service organization, a ministry? You know, this has always been up in the air, and no one seems to know, you know, at different times they're different things. I also argue that they're very much at the cutting edge of innovation, especially in publishing, in the publishing industry. And I don't just mean in American religion there. I mean American history generally. They are the first organization, for example, in the early 19th century to use steam power presses in significant ways. They churn out print Bibles in this case, faster than any other printers in America. They're the first ones to get involved with books in Braille, for example. And then in the 20th century, they're the first ones to embrace things like music videos and, they have this, some things are just, they sort of died out. Like they had this thing called the finger phono, where you stick this disc on a little, looks like a little phonograph and you kind of turn it with your finger and it reads the Bible. But all kinds of innovations, I think, are important. Yeah, then the fourth thing is, which is very related to the other three in some ways, well, maybe to a couple of the other ones, is the American Bible Society has never been connected with a particular denomination. So they've always been interdenominational. And this gets back to what I said before about the no note and comment. They are not interested in interpreting the Bible in any way, shape, or form. Their Bibles are very plain. You know, there's this great controversy in the early 19th century where, there's this translation that in Bengali, they want to translate the Greek word baptizo as immerse, and the American Bible Society won't fund this Bengali Bible because immersion applies a specific denominational, if you will, a Baptist, right, approach to the sacrament of baptism. So it even gets down to that kind of stuff, right? If you translate baptizo, the Greek word immerse, you're writing a Bible for Baptists and not for people who believe in paedobaptism, like a Presbyterian or a Methodist or something like that. So they really make an effort to stay out of denominational politics. Even today, as they're helping churches to interpret the Bible and to engage the Bible, they are open to helping any Christian denomination, Catholic, Protestant, or Orthodox, who want to work with them to develop resources for scriptural engagement.
Yeah, as you were talking about these four different things, and innovation comes to mind, I was thinking about the Bible app that I have on my smartphone here. Were they on the forefront of the smartphone Bible app stuff?
Yes, they were. And this actually creates all kinds of interesting questions, which, I've talked to a lot of these people and interviewed them. The American Bible Society, especially in an age in which many people read their Bibles on their phones now, after 180, 190, almost 200 years of being an organization associated with print, they have been on the cutting edge of trying to say, we're no longer about books. We're no longer about print as much as we are about creative ways of engaging the Bible. So there's one guy there who's their director of communications and one of the vice presidents who's even talking about creating one of these a sort of Bible watch that not only offers you Bible verses like one of these iWatches or iPhone watches, I don't know what they're called, but that actually measures your kind of body temperature and so in other words, if you're feeling anxious, it will provide you, if it reads that your body is feeling anxious, it will provide you with certain verses, right, from Philippians, like be anxious for nothing or something to that effect. They are really trying to come up with innovative ways, and whatever you think about these innovative ways, that's a whole other question, to try to get people to engage with the Bible. So yeah, they're at the cutting edge of all of this stuff.
Yeah, I was looking at my Bible app here on the phone while you were talking. I can't seem to find out who actually published it or put it there, but
there's a lot of them out there now, but the ABS is at the forefront.
Well, let us, we're at the forefront. Let's go way back in history, and we have these four themes of, religious and cultural power, identity always up in the air, being at the forefront of innovation, and as you mentioned, ecumenical approach. Let's start in the year 1816 or thereabouts. What is going on, and how does this ABS society start?
Well, the ABS is very much born out of, an anxiety, a fear that many prominent evangelical political leaders, for the most part, have about the fate of the country. Lo and behold, right, people in the 19th century were concerned about this as well, right, as we talk about this in our own political season. The catalysts were largely what we would call political federalists, For those of your listeners who are familiar with the great Broadway hit Hamilton, you know, these were people who liked Hamilton. They were Federalists. They were mostly older, elite white male politicians who had fought the battles of the American Revolution and the Constitution. They had helped construct the Constitution and so forth. And most of them are at the end of their lives. I think a lot of them are trying to leave a legacy because they believe not only in a strong centralized government, but they also believe that centralized government should be promoting morality and Christianity. So in some ways, they are the sort of first Christian nationalists out there. The most prominent of this group, and the man often described as the founder of the American Bible Society, is Elias Boudinot, who was a right-hand man of George Washington during the Revolutionary War. He was a director of the United States Mint. He was actually the president of the Continental Congress in 1783, the last president of the Continental Congress. He had been in Congress. Boudinot was also sort of an amateur Bible scholar. So he wrote these books. He wrote one book basically arguing that Napoleon Bonaparte was the Antichrist. You know, and in another book he wrote about the 10 lost tribes of Israel were actually the Native Americans. So he's making these kinds of, you know, amateur kind of interpretations, writing these 400 or 500 page books. But probably his most significant book in terms of the founding of the American Bible Society, he wrote a book called The Age of Revelation. And the title of the book played off of Thomas Paine's Age of Reason. Age of Revelation was not as popular, it didn't sell as much, but the whole point of the book was trying to counter Thomas Paine's screed in the Age of Reason against Christianity. And then with the election of Thomas Jefferson in 1800, who was, you know, blasted as a deist, an atheist, an infidel, especially by the Federalist followers of John Adams, Boudinot by 1816 is very much concerned that this Jeffersonian Paineite, if you will, idea is catching on in the United States. As people are moving to the frontiers, they don't have Bibles, so they're going to be open to kind of, you know, non-Christian ideas. He's very worried about children and the next generation. He gets involved with his local Bible society in New Jersey. And eventually, due to some reports he receives from missionaries who are traveling in the West, who say that the West is very heathen, they don't have Bibles, they're going to go the way of infidelity, and even worse, what if the Catholics settle out there? You know, the West could be taken over by these tyrannical popish Catholics. And will no longer be a good Protestant nation. So out of that, Boudinot gathers a lot of his friends in the local Bible societies together, and in 1816 they form a national Bible society, the American Bible Society, for the purpose of distributing the Bible to people who don't have it. And I would argue, although this is not part of the official, you know, verbiage, if you will, in their mission, it's obviously clear that by getting the Bible to people, you are going to somehow save America from the threat of infidelity and reason and all of these other threats to Christian America being a Christian nation.
Yeah, one of the points that you emphasized in the introduction was the ecumenical nature of it, and so he's bringing together lots of different Bible societies from a lot of different Protestant denominations. But the thing that this indicates too about American life is that, yes, America is a melting pot, but it has its limits because, again, this is coming up against Catholicism, and there's some concern about that. And you have a chapter entitled "The Bible is the Religion of Protestantism." How does that play out here in the early part of the 19th century?
Yeah, the what's interesting is, and it's funny, you know, the way in which the present-day American Bible Society sort of cherry-picks from its history. At the time of the founding of the American Bible Society, is actually founded in New York City, actually in City Hall is where the meeting takes place. There is this moment, just as they're about to kind of, you know, declare themselves the American Bible Society, sort of take the, you know, call for the question or something like that, some Quakers and some Catholics enter the meeting and ask if the Quakers and the Catholics can be involved. And they say, certainly you can if you're interested in promoting the Bible. So, you know, the present-day society, which also now does work with Catholics, will appeal to that moment and say, oh, we've worked with Catholics all along. See, it's there in our founding. But once you get into the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, and you see this massive influx of Catholics, German and Irish Catholics, Irish especially in New York City, flooding in, it's very, very clear that whatever that meant in 1816, that Catholics can be involved, quickly disappears, because the American Bible Society is very much going to be concerned about what they would describe as the Catholic menace. Lyman Beecher, who is one of the founders, this 19th century minister, who is known for a lot of things, but he's also known for writing a famous sermon called A Plea for the West. And in that, and this goes back to the previous question, in that he argues that Catholics are coming in, they're going to move out into the West, they're going to take over the country, we're no longer going to be a Protestant country again. So by the 1850s, there is a strong sense of anti-Catholicism, and it's largely because Catholic priests, many of them Irish Catholic priests in cities and other places, are telling their people not to accept American Bible Society Bibles because, A, they don't have the Apocrypha in them, you know, the Catholic books. B, they sense that the American Bible Society is really spreading, and they're right in sensing this, that the American Bible Society is really distributing these Bibles to try to convert you to Protestantism. And so there's examples of Catholic priests telling their parishioners to burn Bibles and so forth, and this doesn't bode very well with the American Bible Society, who also believe that Catholics cannot be good American citizens because they do not have the long-standing anti-Catholicism that you see all the way up into the 1960s in America, because they don't believe in individualism, they don't give you the freedom to read the Bible for yourself, and you know, they answer to the Pope and these sorts of things. So, and you know, there's several popes actually during this period, which I found really interesting. I didn't know this going in. There's several popes in this period who pass encyclicals specifically designed, or write encyclicals specifically designed to condemn the Bible societies and to warn Catholics around the world about the American Bible Society, the British Foreign and Bible Society, the Scotland Bible Society, and other Bible societies. Like, these Bible societies, obviously they're effective because the Pope's worried about them as being threats to Catholicism around the world. And of course, when these encyclicals come out, the American Bible Society sort of responds, and so there is this kind of religious war going on between Catholics and Protestants in the early 19th century, which is, you know, reflective of the larger kind of cultural nativism, if you want to call it that, that's going on in the time.
It gets back to that earlier point we were making at the beginning, talking about history, about understanding people in their cultural context, and you can kind of see the complex nature of it. It's not just merely anti-Catholicism. It's not merely just, the Pope trying to smash Protestantism either. I mean, there's a kind of symbiotic dynamic that is going on between these. And again, it reflects, the cultural ethos of the time.
No, I think you're absolutely right, yeah.
Moving forward, the next big event that comes about is the American Civil War. And so you write about this, and you also write about the era of Reconstruction and the outreach to African Americans. So this is the period covering from, well, I guess you could go back to abolitionist periods, but, say roughly the late 1850s, 1860 through the early 1900s. How does the American Bible Society play out in this whole issue of slavery and Reconstruction and civil rights?
Right. Yeah, the American Bible Society tries to keep its title sort of American, right? The idea behind, they try to rise above the political differences between the Union and the Confederacy and try to say, they make an effort to say, the distribution of the Bible is more important than these political divisions. And really what they're trying to do is they're trying to convince their Southern Bible societies, they were known as auxiliary societies, to continue to work with them, to continue to allow them to provide Bibles to the Confederate states where these local Bible societies operate. So places like the Virginia Bible Society, the South Carolina Bible Society, the Memphis Bible Society, these kinds of state and local Bible societies. That doesn't work because the American Bible Society, because it's based in New York, gets painted out to be a sort of northern benevolent institution. And many of the local Bible societies in the South say we do not want to work with them. And in fact, when the Confederacy forms its own Bible Society, the Confederate States of America Bible Society, they start to work with them instead of the American Bible Society. So when you get to Reconstruction, the American Bible Society sees this as an opportunity, much like, say, the radical Republicans in Congress at the time, or even Abraham Lincoln, to try to heal the nation, right, to bring the nation back together, to bring the Union back together, and to bring, you know, the Bible cause back together and bring these Southern auxiliary Bible societies back into the fold. So what happens is, very similar to some of the rather easy programs of Reconstruction that people like Lincoln and especially Andrew Johnson begin to promote during this period, the American Bible Society basically says, you know, if you are willing to once again start accepting Bibles from us, you know, for distribution in the South, they say this to these Southern auxiliaries, you know, all you need to do is sort of tell us that, you know, send us a letter saying we want to work with you again, and then everything will be fine. The problem is most of the members of these Southern Bible societies are slaveholders. After the war, they continue, even though their slaves are set free, they continue to uphold these very racist ideas. They don't want the slaves to have Bibles because they believe that these Bibles will create, give them democratic ideas and uprisings and so forth. So the American Bible Society doesn't care about that. They just want these Southern Bible societies back on board so they can call themselves a national society again. So in some ways, they put Union over, getting the Bibles to African Americans and so forth. This was the way they handled slavery before the war, too. You know, they were pushed. The American Bible Society was pushed to bring Bibles directly to slaves because the Southern auxiliary Bible societies, the local societies, wouldn't do it. So there's this moment where the American Anti-Slavery Society gives this large sum of money to the American Bible Society, or at least offers this large sum of money, and says, we'll give you all this money and we will fund you to bring Bibles to the South. And the American Bible Society says, no, according to our Constitution, it's only the local societies that can distribute. And since the local societies won't distribute because they won't give Bibles to the slaves, the American Bible Society turns down the money and says, no, it's not our responsibility. In Reconstruction, the American Bible Society works closely with the freedmen's schools. They provide Bibles for the freedmen's schools. But ultimately, after the war and in the era of Jim Crow, they adopt the, to use the phrase from Plessy v. Ferguson in the 1890s, they adopt a kind of separate but equal, again, we could argue whether or not it really is equal, but a sort of separate but equal mentality in which they are going to create, they're going to have their white Bible auxiliaries, their white programs for white Christians, and then they're going to create separate entity for African Americans. They're going to create an African American agency.
Yeah, again, reflecting a lot of what is going on in America writ large, and also an institution looking for its identity, as you mentioned.
Absolutely. Yeah absolutely. And again, their identity is so closely connected to the fate of the nation, right? Mm-hmm. I say at the beginning of the book, they're not only the American Bible Society, but they are the American, right, Bible mm-hmm. Society. The fusion there is seen everywhere in their history.
Yeah, and trying to juggle that can be complex. And another challenge then comes in, too, in the late 19th century, and that is immigration. Immigration increases pretty dramatically, a nation of immigrants from the beginning, but things do definitely start changing in quantity and in the nature, the places where a lot of immigrants come from. How does the Bible Society respond to this?
Yeah, you have to always remember, too, that the American Bible Society is a middle-class, largely white middle class reform society. And their goal is to use, you know, to obviously give the Bible to people so that they'll be saved, right? That they will have eternal life, their life will be transformed by its message and so forth. I don't want to downplay that aspect. But that's what everybody thinks when they think of the American Bible Society. I'm trying to complicate the story by suggesting that they're also at the forefront of trying to build a white Protestant nation in many ways. So when these immigrants start flooding into cities, largely Catholic immigrants now, again, from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, and they start, you know, coming into New York and Philadelphia and Kansas City and San Francisco, the Chinese in San Francisco, the American Bible Society, in their sort of white middle-class reforming, upper-middle-class reforming mentality, wants to create programs to not only teach these people the Bible, but to assimilate them into American culture. So, you know, they work closely, for example, with the Office of Immigration in the United States. So when these immigrants come into Ellis Island, they have to take a literacy test. And the American Bible Society works closely because the American Bible Society has translated the Bible into so many different languages, they are a natural fit in terms of giving them an example, you know, a sort of reading test. You know, they give them a passage from the Bible to read because it's very easy for the immigration offices to get a Bible translated in the language of one of these immigrants, because a lot of the other books that they could use or other pieces of prose that they could use are not translated into other languages. But yet the American Bible Society sees this. The immigration office sees this as just a practical, right? We got to give them something to read in their language so we know they can read. The American Bible Society sees this as, of course, a way of preaching, but also a way of being at the forefront of the assimilation process as these immigrants come in. So the idea is, right, we want to make them good American Protestants, and if we are a Protestant nation, as the American Bible Society in the 19th century and 20th century always believed, you know, we should have an active role to play in bringing the Bible and serving in some ways this immigrant population.
And it's not just immigrants coming to the United States that is changing in the ABS at this time. The ABS starts going abroad. Transportation costs get a little bit lower, and you see the missional movement really kicking in worldwide, and they're part of this. And you have several chapters that emphasize their role in the Levant, in Mexico, and in China. And there's a few other places around the world that they get involved, but those are the primary places. What is going on here?
Well, by the time you get to World War II, the American Bible Society is pretty much everywhere in the world. And, you know, it's not just the American Bible Society. They always are sharing responsibilities for this with the British Foreign and the British Foreign Bible Society, British Foreign, you know, BFBS, British Foreign Bible Society, I think is the name of it. Scotland has a Bible Society. They're there. So what they do is they go into these places and they divide the territory up. You know, in China, for example, the Scotland Bible Society has their sector. The British Foreign Bible Society has theirs and so forth. American Bible Society has theirs. But again, here's another way in which the American Bible Society is connected to sort of these larger trends in American history. As American imperialism starts to kick in the late 19th and early 20th century, you know, the American Bible Society goes with the promoters of American democracy and American Christianity. What's fascinating is it's really in the overseas context, especially in the Levant. And this is where I'm actually borrowing from an argument from Peter Woesch, who wrote a book about the 19th century Bible Society back in the 1980s, which is a very good book called The Bible Business. It's in the Levant that you really see the American Bible Society's role less as a missionary or evangelistic agency per se, and more as a service organization. And there's a lot of debate about this. So there is this man named Isaac Bliss who runs the Constantinople Bible House, and he insists that our job is to sell Bibles to missionaries, and basically, you know, service missionaries, support Bibles. We are not there to preach. We are not there to evangelize. We are there as a Bible business certainly with a sort of social entrepreneur kind of thing, certainly a religious entrepreneurship, right? We want to make money selling Bibles, but we also have a mission because we believe the Bible has a life-transforming message. But our goal is not to try to convert people, but to support or service the missionaries who are trying to convert Muslims and Greek Orthodox and others to Christianity. So it's really in this foreign context, in Levant and then eventually in China, you have these, you know, colporteurs who travel around these countries, many of them Westerners, but many of them are trained, you know, locals who sell Bibles. And, you know, the idea is we could give you a Bible for free, but you may not appreciate it as much. If you're willing to, you know, fork over a couple of dollars or yen or whatever it might be for a Bible, you may actually care for that Bible and actually read that Bible. So it's this interesting kind of blend of business practice, salesmanship, right, selling a product, consumerism, with a sort of deeply spiritual mission attached to it.
Yeah, and again, this is the theme that starts arising in the 20th century that we talked about at the beginning, and we see a shift away from the service organization to a missional strategy. So
right.
tell us about the 20th century. How does the identity of the American Bible Society change? How does it, is it affected by ecumenical relations? There's a couple big events that occur in the 20th century that are transformative, World War I, World War II, but also the Second Vatican Council. So take us through the 1900s.
Yeah, just really quickly, before getting into the Catholic Vatican II stuff, one of the big controversies is around the Revised Standard Version of the Bible. For, you know, the initial constitution of the American Bible Society always said that they would promote and circulate the Bible in, quote-unquote, the common use, and that was always King James. The Revised Standard Version, which the evangelicals hated because they believed it came out of a sort of ecumenical right type of movement, and you know, so for example, they translated the word, the Hebrew word Alma in Isaiah to mean young woman instead of virgin, to describe, you know, the person who will one day give birth to the Messiah, you know. So there's that kind of, that's an example of them very much when the American Bible Society starts to distribute and sell the Revised Standard Version, that in and of itself, you know, is a not only marks its mainline ideas, but also alienates evangelicals. But the real ecumenical conversations, as you mentioned, are going on in the 1960s and 1970s with Catholics. After Vatican II, the Catholic Church is much more open to interacting with Protestants. They actually, you know, talk about Protestants as kind of, you know, they're. You know, you can still be a legitimate Christian and be a Protestant in that sense. And there are, straight out of the Vatican, there are efforts then to work with Protestant Bible translators Bible scholars, to come up with a common Greek text and Hebrew text that can be then, they can use for their joint translation projects. And Catholic Bible scholars and Protestant Bible scholars will actually work together on not only creating these texts, but on translating the Bible for foreign countries that don't have the Bible in their own language. This is a huge step because never before, you know, sort of unofficially, Catholic Bible scholars and Protestant Bible scholars had been in dialogue with one another at various, you know, academic conferences and so forth. But with the Vatican's blessing, this is the first time that there's actually some sort of official kind of rapprochement between the world of Protestant biblical scholarship and Catholic biblical scholarship. And in some ways, this converges as well in the mid-1960s, when the American Bible Society for the first time publishes their own English translation of the Bible. It's known as Good News for Modern Man. It's the Good News translation, or often referred to as Today's English Version. And it's here that the translators work with Catholics as well. And Good News for Modern Man, which is this very accessible translation to the Bible written in common language, you know, this would predate some of the more evangelical popular translations like The Message and, you know, these kinds of or the Living Bible and so forth. Catholics embrace Good News for Modern Man, and then later the Good News for Modern Man is the New Testament, and later the Good News Bible is the complete Bible. Catholics embrace this, so they use it in their Catholic schools and so forth. So by the late 1960s, the mainline Protestants who were running the American Bible Society and the Vatican are working together to produce Bibles. The American Bible Societies are now producing Bibles with the Apocrypha in them. The local bishops in the United States are endorsing American Bible Society products. And this then moves, of course, into the future. From this point forward, the American Bible Society will do work with Catholic diocese and other Catholic organizations that want to help them promote the Bible.
And just at the time that this is happening, that there's a greater ecumenical opening to Catholics and they're all working together, Protestantism itself starts to go through another ferment, a revival of evangelical movements that continues into the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s. How does the American Bible Society go with this flow?
Yeah. Again, this is probably, for me at least, this is the most fascinating part of the story because, you know, I talk to evangelicals, older evangelicals, you know, who said, you know, I said, what comes to mind when you think about the American Bible Society? And many of them said, like, you know, either they refer to it as liberal, or they would talk about, like, we didn't support them because of their ecumenical connections. Many missionaries really felt betrayed that the American Bible Society was working now with Catholics. Of course, many evangelicals in the 60s still believe that, you know, Catholics, you know, either were the Antichrist or, you know, really were not true Christians and so forth. And, you know, we still see some of this even today. But what's fascinating is the American Bible Society, remember, they're always looking to work with those who are in some kind of cultural authority or cultural power. At the same time, they also legitimately want to deliver the Bible to people who want to read the Bible and work with people who love the Bible and want to promote the Bible. So you don't see this publicly as much as you see it internally in sort of meetings and so forth, where the leadership of the American Bible Society begins to say, you know, mainline Protestants, the average mainline Protestant in the pew doesn't seem to be as interested as much with the in the Bible. And this is also a time where conservative churches are growing, mainline Protestants are on the decline in the 1970s and 1980s, but they do see a sort of, they discover in some ways these evangelicals, and a lot of it has to do with their, you know, they're finally coming out of sort of hiding, you know, with the moral majority, and they're getting engaged in politics and so forth. You know, there's a president in 1976 who claims to be born again, Jimmy Carter. Newsweek in 1976 declares it to be the year of the evangelical. Evangelicals are coming out of hiding after what I would argue was the devastating Scopes trial in 1925, which kind of, you know, drove them out of public life. Anyway, the American Bible Society says we need to think more seriously about how to deal with these, minister to, bring the Bible to, at least, maybe minister's not the best word because they still saw themselves as a service organization, bring the Bible to these people, bring the Bible to evangelicals. They start calling in more and more evangelical organizations like the leadership of the National Association of Evangelicals to come in and have conversations with them, what can we do, and so forth. So by the 1980s, 1990s, you begin to see a subtle change even in the leadership. And in 1990, the new president of the American Bible Society, his name was Eugene Habecker. Habecker really starts to turn the American Bible Society in a much more evangelical direction. He himself is an evangelical. And it's at this point as well that the American Bible Society ceases to be a service organization. Habecker actually says, you know, every 95% of American households have a Bible. Maybe the 200-year-old, by this point it was only about 180-year-old project, of distributing and circulating the Bible has reached its point, you know, reached its saturation point. It's over, right? So we either close up shop, right, or we rethink our mission. And as an evangelical, Habecker is very interested in then, you know, getting evangelicals and anyone else who wants to come along, right? But evangelicals to again, engage the Bible, to use the Bible. And that's that transition we talked about at the beginning of the interview.
Yeah, it brings us full circle, these interesting trends and changes and, you know,
right,
being a historian, you know, at a time of interesting cultural change and institutional change, it's kind of neat to look back and say, you know, we've seen a lot of this before, and you are able to evaluate today in the context of the past, as you say in your other book, Why Study History.
I mean, one of the things I think I can't remember if I mentioned it or not, you know, one of the reasons we need to study history is we need to, you know, grasp the idea of change over time, right? Mm-hmm. Things change, and we need to analyze, you know, did they change for the better, for the worse, and so forth. Yeah, exactly right.
So let me finish off with this last question. Now we're kind of back where we started. You're in the living room in Nebraska with Mr. Erickson, and, you know, also looking at the archives there in New York City, then moving to Philadelphia. So interesting point in time. Your own reflections on this project. I mean, again, you were approached to do this, and they said, hey, here's what we want you to do, and you negotiated with them a little bit. Was there anything in the process of writing this, I guess, over about a year and a half period or so, that you really changed your mind on something and that you said, wow, that kind of surprised me? You already indicated some of it, but what other big themes
in
that
terms
you
of the content of the book, I've suggested a few things, right? You know, the 20th century, I'm by training an early American historian, so the 20th century stuff was very enlightening to me and fun to do. Let me answer that question another way, Tony. I think I maybe mentioned this earlier, I can't remember now, but I'm not sure I would write I'm not sure I would write a history of another institution that is actually still functioning, you know, as an institution. It's very hard to write an academic history and be true to my identity as a scholar, as an American historian, and at the same time write a book that the institution is going to like. Let's put it that way. So, you know, there are some parts of my story that many in the American Bible Society, I think, feel a little bit uncomfortable about. And if they were to write their own history, they probably would not have included. I'm thinking of stuff about slavery and Reconstruction and race and those kinds of things. But I'm also thinking here about their concern about being too connected to American nationalism. You know, the American Bible Society does not want to be seen as kind of promoters of a Christian nation. That's viewed as a sort of a bad thing for them, because they don't want to limit, you know, they don't want to be pigeonholed as, you know, this or that kind of organization. So they feel uncomfortable in some ways with that. On the other side, you know, I also hope that the people who read this book are the thousands and thousands of people who, you know, perhaps, you know, ordinary Christians maybe, who give money to the American Bible Society and want to know something about the history of the organization. And in that way, I have in some ways tried to write for that audience as well, which has drawn some criticism, at least in the early reviews, from people, scholars, who are saying, you know, well, you give too much credit to the words of the American Bible Society. You don't deconstruct their, you know, you don't deconstruct them or not as much. When they say this, they really mean this, and you don't point that out. So it's a very hard book to sort of navigate in terms of audience, and then in terms of trying to please the institution and give them a book worthy of their 200th anniversary, but at the same time be a critical historian.
Well, that I think is something that you do very well, and as you return back to American history, early American history, as you move through your sabbatical here and then eventually pass through the chair department of Messiah History Department.
It can't come soon enough.
It can't come soon enough. We'll be looking for a lot more writings from you and have you back on the program again. My guest today has been John Fia. John, thanks for coming back again to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. I hope we get a chance to do it yet another time.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.